This is an ABC podcast.
Kumin Lu has always loved TV. As a kid, she loved TV so much that even when her parents had two TVs and two VCRs, that still wasn't enough to fill her insatiable TV hunger. So Q organised a network of neighbours and friends to tape more shows in order to ensure there was not a moment of Australian television she was missing out on. This early immersion in television has served Q well because she grew up to become an executive producer with ABC TV. Q was behind a raft of innovative shows, including the drama series The Heights and the comedy content, which is designed to be watched on your phone. But at the same time that Q's professional life was striding ahead in leaps and bounds, her personal life was thrown into chaos when her husband, the radio maker Jesse Cox, became gravely ill. Hi Q, welcome to Conversations.
Hi, nice to be here.
What shows did you love most as a kid? What were you watching all those hours?
Look, my favourite show was Press Gang as a child, but I was quite obsessed with Australian TV. Really into shows like Water Rats.
And what did you love about Water Rats, do you think?
Oh, you know, it was the sassy relationship between the two detectives. It was just, it was just a different world to me.
Escapism.
Escapism, yeah. Defeating the bad guys and solving the mysteries, that appealed to me.
Were any limits put on how much TV you could watch as a kid?
No. Well, my mum was always working, so I just watched as much as I wanted. And it was a very strict household, so in some respects, so I wasn't really allowed to go out per se, so I spent a lot of time at home. I did read some books, but by and large it was about, you know, how to operate the VCR and just watching what I could.
And so what system did you have with neighbours to do extra taping for you?
back in the day you only had five channels to choose from, but it wasn't unlikely for me to for there to be five shows on at the same time that I'd want to watch. So I'd have the two, I'd watch one, record a different channel. On the other VCR, I'd record something else, and then I'd have my next door neighbour recording something and two other friends recording something as well. And then I'd just gather the tapes. And I just had a cycle of about five VHS tapes that I would just tape over again and again so I could just, get my weekly's viewing done and then start again.
I'm surprised you had time for anything else. This is a heavy schedule.
I didn't have time for anything else.
That's the thing. In all of those hours and hours of viewing, how often did you see people on the screens who looked like you?
Never. I think when I was super duper young, there was I watched an episode of The Henderson Kids, and there was a Vietnamese character on it who was like a boat person stowaway that they discover and help. I can't remember what happened to him, but I remember watching it and going, oh, is that it? You know, and I, you know, again, my favourite show is Press Gang, and the closest thing to a person of colour on that show was the character Fraz, who wasn't even Asian, but I thought, you'll do. So there was next to nothing.
Did that bug you? Were you aware at the time that?
No, I wasn't conscious of the lack of it. And what it did was make me yearn for a life like the kind that you would see on TV, because my life was quite different. My family upbringing and the family environment was quite different to the families that you saw on screen. And I just yearned for that kind of a family. Yeah.
How did the shows that you produce now or involved with now, how did they compare to the shows you loved growing up?
You know, the ones I work on now, particularly in the capacity of the job I'm in, the desire for diversity and inclusion and some kind of authentic representation of the real world is paramount when we're commissioning shows. So it's just something that you think about now that it just wasn't considered by default back in the day. And it took me many years to firstly to even identify that was a problem, and then to figure out a way to fix that. And, you know, part of the reason why I went into executive producing, which I did, you know, fairly late, relatively late in my career, after I was an editor for a number of years before that, was because as an editor, I didn't have any impact or any say in what went on screen. Like I could play with the way the story was told to a certain extent and the order in which things were told, but really there were things that were set in stone, like the casting and who wrote it and who worked on it. So, you know, and I was very much a minority in the crews there as well. So, yeah, it was about being more conscious of that, which was a real privilege.
You talked, Q, about the difference between the lives that you were seeing on the screens of TV when you were a kid and the life of your own family. What do you know about your parents' story, about how they came to Australia?
Well, you know, what I know is fairly patchy and has been gleaned over many years of bits of information my mum has dropped. But the story I understand is, as I understand it, is my two sisters who were, you know, 4, 5 and 3 at the time, and my mother and father escaped Vietnam from the war, went onto a boat with a bunch of other people who were also escaping and, you know, set off to try to leave, and then were caught by the Viet Cong and, but because my dad was ethnically Chinese, they let him go, and my mother and sisters. So whoever was let go was allowed to remain on the boat. Everyone else was arrested. But before they let them go, they removed the engine from the boat. So they were just set off drifting for some weeks until they, by sheer luck, you know, came upon a shore of one of the islands off the Philippines, and the locals there helped them to land and took them in. So they were in a refugee camp for upwards of a year, during which time they lived in tents, and my mum set about applying for asylum to a number of countries, and Australia was the one that allowed them in. So they arrived in Australia, and I was born very shortly within, you know, a month or two after that fact. So,
wow. How does your mum talk about that time as a refugee, being on that boat and living in the camps? Is that something she'd speak about much?
Very flippantly. So it's not something, you know, where everyone huddles around her and she says, "Let me tell you a story, kids, about how we came to the country." It's none of that. None of that. So it's effortlessly and flippantly dropped in conversation, if at all. It's not something that's often discussed. It's, you glean things from bits and bobs. I mean, we went to Vietnam as a family a bit over 10 years ago, and we heard a little bit more about her life as a young girl growing up in Vietnam. But other than that, you know, we don't talk about it much. She might go as far as to say, "Ugh, I don't want to, you know, go into that tough stuff." So, she's a tough broad, and she just kind of keeps calm and carries on.
Whereabouts in Sydney did your family settle once they made it to Australia?
So there was some time in a kind of refugee hostel in Chester Hill in Sydney, and then they were in Fairfield. We moved to Walker for a bit in the country, where we were sponsored by an Australian family there. And then we came back to Sydney, and I grew up in the southwestern Sydney area of Fairfield and Cabramatta, kind of bordering on Villawood as well. So I was there until I was in my early 20s.
And what was that neighbourhood like for you growing up?
Very multicultural. And it's funny, I didn't make that connection between, oh, I live in a very multicultural world, this is the world I see, and the world I see on TV is very white. And, you know, to me, the world on TV was the normal one that I should aspire to. And the one that I saw was like, well, what is this crazy place that I'm in, and how can I get to over there? So it was really multicultural, full of, you know, Vietnamese, other Southeast Asians and East Asians, Middle Eastern people, lots of Portuguese people and Polish people, and, you know.
Not at all like the Henderson kids.
Not at all like the Henderson kids, no.
In that period in the 90s, Cabramatta became kind of synonymous with the heroin trade in Australia. Mm. Were you aware of that as a teenager?
I was, but it was completely normalised for us. So it's not like, I mean, I certainly had friends of friends, and maybe some kind of relatives who were involved in the gangs and drugs and what have you, but it really didn't. I mean, I was such a nerd burger growing up. I was quite immune to not really understanding the implications of that world, but I was aware of it, and I was aware of how it was seen in the media, and I was aware that heroin was, you know, a dangerous drug, but it was just part and parcel of growing up there. It didn't affect me, you know, substantially. It was certainly the setting of where I grew up, but it wasn't a huge. I wasn't frightened by it by any means.
Is it something that your mum felt she had to warn you against, or it was just understood?
It was just understood. I mean, we were all nerd burgers, to be frank. And she, you know, she was very preoccupied with our ongoing financial security. So it's not an uncommon thing for Asian parents, or rather any parent of any ethnicity, to be, to apply the pressure on their kids to study and what have you. And I certainly was no exception to that.
When they said study to you, Q, what did that mean? What
I don't know.
What did they want you to do? Did they tell you what that meant in practice?
No. And I, you know, my sister was very good at studying. It was a classic older kid thing of being the one who was responsible and who would study really hard. And, you know, as you filter down to the next kid and the next kid, you kind of stop explaining that stuff. And, you know, that's no slight against my mother. She was too busy working, you know, graveyard shifts and what have you to kind of go into any further explanation. But I had no idea what study meant. It was something about books and doing homework, but that was it. So I just kind of watched a lot of TV and blagged my way through the rest of it. So
your mum got a job at Australia Post not long after she arrived mm-hmm. in Australia. Why was she sacked from that job?
So she was sacked because she was seen to be, and another colleague of hers who was also Vietnamese, they were sacked for being underweight.
For being underweight.
And the idea behind it was that you needed to be of a certain weight to push some of the heavy trolleys of mail around the facility. So they were seen to be too underweight to be able to do that job. So they were sacked. And it was tough because Australia Post at that time, and still to this day, has a lot of Vietnamese people in the community working there. I still know a lot of my friends have parents who knew my mum because they all worked at Australia Post at the time.
That would have been a huge thing for her.
So it was a really huge thing to be sacked.
For such a strange, it seems, sort of issue as well, being underweight. What did your mum do after that?
So she, with the help of Kingsford Legal Centre, filed an unfair dismissal claim with this other colleague. And they eventually took Australia Post all the way to the High Court. And there's case law named after my mum, which I didn't realise until, you know, a few months ago. I just remember her being sacked and being a really tiny kid and seeing us all huddling around the TV to watch a story about her on A Current Affair over that whole thing. Because their argument against the discrimination claim, or for the discrimination claim, was if you're sacking people for being underweight, which was not an uncommon thing for Vietnamese people who had smaller frames and what have you, why aren't you sacking people for being overweight? So she took them all the way to the High Court.
The Current Affair would have loved that story.
They loved it. There's a shot of her pointing at some finger buns in the story. I would love to find that story. I don't know quite how to find that story, but I would love to dive into the Current Affair archives to find that story of my mum.
It's so ballsy that she took that to the Supreme Court or went with that.
Yeah, like, High Court. Like, you know, for a woman who had only been in the country for a couple of years to do that, but she was always a bit of an activist back in Vietnam, and she was the union rep, and she's a bit proletariat so in general. So, you know, it also makes a lot of sense, but it takes a lot of guts to do that.
And how did the court find that case? What was the result?
They ultimately lost. My understanding is that they saw Australia Post as being a federal agency, not being beholden to state anti-discrimination laws, which was the laws they were arguing on. So they ultimately lost, but I mean, it took like 5 or 6 years for it to get to the High Court. And in that time, my mum went to TAFE to study accounting so she could, you know, get another job, but somehow managed, I can't remember why, she got her job back at Australia Post anyway. And they gave her a really small payout, very small. But for her, she was just glad to have the job. For her, it was about stable income. She had three kids to take care of. She went back and there she stayed for another 30 years.
She must know a lot of postcodes.
She does. You know, she had a really great party trick for a while. You go, hey, Mum, what's the postcode to Bargo? And she'd be like, 2560 or whatever it is. And she could just, her ability to recall those postcodes was a very neat party trick. Not that she went to any parties. But.
How were things between your mum and your dad when you were a kid?
Not great. I think it's safe to say that my dad was not a particularly nice person to us and particularly to my mum. So she did all the emotional labour around organising our lives, like dealing with the administration of, our welfare system and benefits, social benefits and all of that stuff. And she had the stable job and he was forever quitting jobs and being unemployed and what have you. And he just wasn't very kind to her, to say the least, or to any of us.
Did you experience his temper or his anger yourself as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, look, my siblings definitely experienced it far more than I did. But, I remember being 8 and being forced to stand in the rain, you know, for some punishment that for something that I didn't really understand. He was just, you know, the type of person who would fly off into rages and what have you. So it was a very tense household. So when he left, we all breathed a sigh of relief, which he did when I was about 13. And by that stage, I had a little brother and he was 1. So
your mum was at home as a single mum with four kids
and working and, you know, she would do, I mean, she was the parent who would work her ass off to send us to Catholic school because that was as close to private school, like real private school, as she could get for us. She'd sew all our uniforms. She did all of that stuff plus work, plus cook. Like we were never hungry, I never wanted for anything other than, you know, Reebok pumps or something. So,
did she have to take on extra work in addition to a job at Australia Post?
Yeah. So she, and this was very common for Vietnamese families around the time, but she had a bit of a backyard sweatshop operation working. So she had an industrial sewing machine and an overlock, and she would just get bags and bags of clothes for fashion labels to sew that she would do on her off hours. And I would sit there next to her snipping off, you know, she would just sew overlock, like hundreds of pockets one after the other. And my job was to snip off the threads to separate the pockets after she'd run them through the overlocker machine, and she'd pay me $2 for my hard work. But she used to do that as well as work at Australia Post, as well as take care of us, as well as translate the paper for my dad, as well as, you know, like constantly readjust and manage the money when he was out of work and that sort of thing. So she did everything. Yeah.
Did she worry about you as you became a teenager, Q? Were you getting interested in stuff or changing in a way that maybe was a bit stressful for a mum as busy and overloaded as your mum was?
I mean, my sisters were very... The eldest, she was very studious and you know, ambitious, and as God is my witness, I will never go hungry again, and, you know, very, you know, wanted to study law and commerce and just make a lot of money to support my mum. And my other sister was very studious and bookish and what have you, and I was dyeing my hair green and pink and being a massive alternatine, and you know, she thought I was going to end up a teenage mum or something, which was a little bit catastrophizing.
That's how you get from hair dye. That's how it happens.
Exactly. It's a slippery slope. But all I really wanted to do was make myself distinct from that stereotype of what, you know, a Vietnamese or Asian person was, in this, particularly in the 90s and in the climate of Pauline Hanson, to and it's awful, like it's internalized racism, I suppose, but it was me saying, I'm not like that. I'm assimilated. I was really, really committed to assimilating, which doesn't explain the hair, but generally I was...
You didn't want to be a stereotypical, quote unquote, Asian girl.
Exactly. And, you know, I have a lot of regret over that, but that was...
What do you regret?
It's, you know, I made a very conscious step back from the language. You know, now my Vietnamese is terrible. I only really understand what's being said if my mum is yelling it to me. So I don't, the language thing is a really big barrier to knowing your family and knowing your culture and what have you. So I regret not knowing my roots as much as I could have at the time, because the impact of experiencing everyday racism, casual racism, and then outright kind of really hateful racism, particularly in that Pauline Hanson era of politics, was really, it was fear-mongering. So I didn't understand what it meant to stand up to that. I just let it lie and tried to be something else.
What did your mum think about you wanting to work in media?
She didn't understand it, but luckily I had a sister who decided she was going to do a Bachelor of Arts degree. So that really paved the way for me in terms of, you know, the extreme disappointment and anguish my mum felt at my sister's future job prospects, even though she's completely fine now. But at the time, she was frightened. So me being able to do media was a really relatively easy path for me. But, you know, I still decided to specialise in editing because it involved working with computers. And that was something I could say to my mum, as I'm working with computers, it's fine. Like, she didn't
It's not
to.
Creative, don't
it's
worry.
It's not creative, just it's computers. Fine. It's computers. So it's adjacent to being a programmer. So that kind of got it past her, I suppose. I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of unexpressed anguish that I was unaware of, because she does have a habit of not telling me things to my face. But yeah, she that's how I got how I got through.
How did you first meet Jesse Q?
Jesse and I met at FBI Radio in Sydney, which is a community radio station, and we were both volunteers. And I was producing the film show with Kate Jinks, and Jesse was producing a documentary storytelling program that he co-created called All the Bests, which is something that's still running today. And so we would kind of cross paths in the producer booth and kind of connect over shared, you know, what does your run sheet look like? What does your run sheet look like? Look at this Excel formula I've put in. And we kind of connected over that, and that's how we met.
What did you like about him?
He was just supremely organized, and I was really impressed at how committed he was to running this radio show as a volunteer, but he treated it like a full-time job. And his ability to facilitate the creativity and the skills building of all these young people who were really keen to get into documentary storytelling was really impressive. And we just got along.
Probably didn't hurt that he is very handsome.
He was really handsome. I still think about that sometimes, about how handsome he was. And sometimes I think, particularly now that he's gone, sometimes I look at a photo and go, I feel like posting this. Like, does anyone else not notice how handsome he was? Like, I bagged this handsome person. If nothing else, if I'm alone for the rest of my life, there's proof that I managed to bag a hottie.
How different was his family background to yours?
Oh, so different. You know, he grew up in the inner west of Sydney to super feminist, progressive parents who thought nothing of taking the kids out for 6 months, the kids out of school for 6 months of the year to travel in Asia. And so they were so focused on experiences and allowing or giving their kids the freedom to figure it out what they wanted to do creatively, like very encouraging creatively, which was the complete opposite in my family. It was all about study and achievement and numbers, I suppose. And I understand why, because, you know, when you're coming from a place of near poverty, you want as many assurances as you can get that you're going to be okay. And so your focus is on sustaining a life, not kind of fulfilling one, I suppose. And his family was just really different, polar opposite in that respect. They understood, well, they had the privilege of giving their kids the space to consider that as you know, consider art and consider stories, have tap dancing lessons, that sort of thing.
White so privilege.
Really, yeah, white
tap dancing.
Tap dancing is white privilege.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio.
Q, you were talking about Jesse and the difference in your family backgrounds, and I'm sure that was part of the appeal for both of you in getting together. You had a son together. How was that after your little boy came along?
Well, firstly, my kid is great, but once we had him, 6 weeks into it, we were like, let's never do this again. And I was very much feeling like I'd made a huge mistake. So I wasn't terribly well for the first year of his time on earth. And to this day, I look at his little newborn photos and I don't see a cute baby. I just see like terror. So it was a hard time.
Were you getting support during that?
Yeah, look, my in-laws are so, so great. I mean, it was really my mother-in-law who said, I think that maybe you need to get some help. They were a huge support. And also Jesse was just a stand-up dude in terms of he would go to work. But before he'd go to work, he'd make sure I was stationed with as many nutritious snacks in one spot because I couldn't not hold the baby because he was a screamer. And, you know, it was a really tough time, but you know, I ended up being medicated for it and just working out how to get through it for that first year. But it was super tough.
When did Jesse first become ill?
I guess the tough thing about not having a great first year of being a parent is you delay a lot of the things, the self-care things that you would normally do sooner. And Jess had a lump in his leg that he'd had for a while and he thought was a bike accident. It was an injury and he'd been planning to go and see a physio about it but had put it off because I wasn't well. We were strapped for cash. We had a mortgage. He needed to work, all of that sort of stuff. So he didn't really get himself checked out until towards the end of the year. He went to the physio. The physio said, yeah, I'm not touching that lump. You should go see a doctor. And that just kind of spiraled from there with a lot of doctors just upwards referring us to specialists and more specialists. And then he got a scan and we were told that it was possibly cancer, which was confirmed once he had the biopsy. So that happened around Christmas.
And what kind of cancer was it?
It was a really rare cancer called alveolar soft part sarcoma. I think 1% of the cancer patients that RPA in Sydney see have. So we didn't know anyone else with it, which was really tough, and it's an incurable disease. And so all you can really do is treat it. We were told, and from our research had understood it to be a really slow-growing cancer. So we thought we had time to work out how to treat it and how to manage it. But the first port of call was just removing the tumour that he had in his leg, which was quite sizable. So he went into surgery and had it taken out. And we didn't know whether or not he was going to have a leg when he got out. We didn't know if he was going to have a leg, but it wouldn't be functioning. But, you know, we were really lucky that they'd saved his leg. He'd lost some nerves, but at least he was walking.
In those earlier stages where you're just grappling with this thing that's hit you out of the blue as a couple, what kind of stress did it create between the two of you? What does that do to a relationship to suddenly get this diagnosis lobbed in on it?
Look, we bickered a lot. And it was really tense because, you know, my job was to keep the house going and Jess's way of dealing with stress was to plan and to organise himself and to spend time with our kid. So he stopped seeing so many friends. We really shrunk our kind of social circle to friends with other kids, and Jess's focus was just on our son and spending as much time as he could with him. And with us, you know, it was just stiff upper lip, upwards and onwards.
Was there ever any gallows humour or joking to get you through some of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to find things funny, oddly. It's like a kid who's in trouble and starts laughing and can't stop and then just keeps laughing even though the teacher's yelling at them or whatever. But we, you know, when we knew his leg was going to be operated on and we didn't know whether or not he was going to be okay or have a leg, you know, I mean, my thought process was very much, oh my God, you have cancer. Are you going to be okay? Is our son going to be okay? And three, are we going to get a disability parking permit?
The Holy Grail in Sydney.
Well, yeah. So, and you know, we both joked that way because jokes are all we have right now. So it helped to let us talk about death and injury and disease in a way that was one step removed from the rawness of, oh my God, what is going to happen to us?
How did you understand the kind of support that was around you? How did you visualize your relationship to Jesse and then friends and family's relationship to you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it was the first experience I've had dealing with a family member who was so close to me and so ill. I mean, we had such a great support network of friends, but one of the things I learned about in the course of, you know, being the support person for someone with cancer was I'd read about this idea of the circle of support theory. And the idea behind it is that if you draw a number of concentric circles, the person who is going through the thing is right at the center in that first circle. And in the next concentric circle, it's, you know, their carer. And then the next circle is their family, then their friends, then their community at large. The idea was that comfort had to come into the circle and bad feelings you could dump outwards. So Jess being at the center could say whatever the hell he wanted and rant and rave and say life is unfair. And I would say, yes, absolutely. And I could dump, but I could never dump to Jess. I could only dump outwards to the next circle. And that really helped as a rule, which isn't to say I never expressed my worries to him because we were in it together, but it was just a really helpful way of saying this is how support needs to work for us when we're talking about what family and friends can do for us.
Was Jesse open with friends and colleagues about his illness?
Not really. No, he was really determined not to be defined by, he didn't want to be known to be the guy with cancer. And so, you know, obviously our friends knew, his bosses knew, some of his colleagues knew, but generally he just went on with work. And if it wasn't summer and you couldn't see his compression stocking, he was just Jess, regular Jess. And, you know, he put in hard hours and worked his butt off. And
how did you feel about that, watching him work those long hours and give so much?
It was what he needed to do, and that was how he operated. His way of dealing with stress was to work and to organise. And being able to work and to contribute to the audio industry and community as he did was really important to him and brought a lot of meaning to his life. So it was all about helping facilitate him to be able to do as much of that as possible. That's where he derived meaning from. It was his son and his work
and
me. But, but yeah, his work was really important to him.
As he was aware that he was getting more and more ill, what kind of planning did he do for you and your son? What was he putting his mind to?
He was always a planner. I mean, when I first got pregnant, this was more than a year before he even was diagnosed or had a sense that he was sick, he said, okay, you're pregnant, we need to sort out our life insurance policies. And he spent a week researching and figuring out which was the best policy and what I needed to do. And then he just said, sign here, do this. You know, he was always the project manager, life project manager. So he was very, very thoughtful and considered. And I don't know anyone else in their late 20s who's like thinking about life insurance policies, but he was. And, you know, the sicker he got, the more organized he got. So it was about the wills. What happens if both of us die? Like, do I need to be, me being Q, like, what do I need to be supported in case of him being gone? So that's what he focused on relentlessly. It was, you know, the most attractive thing about him, but apart from his general handsomeness, but it was very unique. And
it never felt to you that he was assuming a terrible outcome by having that focus?
Look, in hindsight, I think he knew that he didn't have much. Like I said, I had read about this disease as being something that you would live with for 20 years and you would just deal with as, you know, new tumours came or whether or not you were able to kind of eliminate them altogether. So it was a real... it was a real shock to lose him after two. In hindsight, he knew. I assumed that we had years left, and I behaved as such. And I think that probably made him feel a little bit more isolated, which I regret.
What kind of things did he focus on with your son when you say he was so conscious of spending that time with him? What would they do together?
Regular parent-child stuff. He'd take him to the park, try to teach him how to ride. Alfie was two and was obsessed with this book from the 80s of, like, non-alcoholic cocktails that Berry Juices had published. And he'd read it with Jess and make him, because all the drinks look so delicious, he would point them out and say, what does that one say? And Jess would say, Berry Delight. And Alfie would pretend to taste it. And, you know, they just do, like, it was the minutiae of, like, every day. He wasn't, like, taking him to Disneyland or anything. It was just that one-on-one time and presence and building of that sense memory. Because I guess he had this sense that Alfie ultimately wasn't going to remember him.
How quickly did Jesse's health deteriorate at the end of 2017?
Look, the timeline was essentially lump in his leg surgery. So that was around Christmas. And by the following Christmas, it was in his lungs. And then by the following Christmas, he was gone. It had gone to his brain. So it moved really quickly.
Were you left in shock after that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because we had just seen our oncologist on the Friday before he passed away, and that's when we got the news that the medication he was on was not working. But we had good news that the experimental treatment that we were wanting, that was, you know, the $7,000 a month medication, was now on the PBS. So, you know, the doctor was like, we're going to get you on that first thing within a week. It's going to happen really quickly. And Jess had mentioned headaches and the doctor had said, okay, we'll look into that as well. But then 2 days later, he was gone. So it was really quick. And the things I'm grateful for is that he was at work right up until basically the day he went into hospital, and he went to a party on the following night, which was just like a reunion of all of his friends. And I pushed him to go, and he did. He stayed there, saw everyone, and then went for a swim. And then on Sunday, he was in bed. We went out to dinner with some friends, and then he had to go into hospital. So it was sudden, really sudden.
Did you find in the days, weeks after that sudden loss that you could talk to about what you'd been through, what you were going through?
Look, I had so much support, I realised, like, so much. I was so lucky, not just from the planning that Jess had made, but our friends and family. I mean, I also had known about a club called the Hot Young Widows Club.
It's a great title.
Yeah, which was really great. It was run by this woman who had also lost her husband at a young age to brain cancer. And she had queried where all the young widows were, because, you know, the stereotypical idea of a widow is, or a widower is old and having had, you know, 30 good years with their partner or something. And so she got together with another fellow grieving woman, and they set up this club, and it just became this Facebook group of people who had lost their partners, you know, commiserating with each other. And everyone was, you know, at varying stages of grief. Some were ready to date. Some were onto their chapter twos, as they call it. Some had just lost their partners the day before or the day of. And it was a really comforting place for me to be, absolutely uninhibited if I wanted to, which was rare, but mostly just reading the experiences of other people who were of my age and trying to find similarities and things that I could relate to that helped me understand what this process was going to be like. So yeah, that group was really great. Just having that those people there, I mean, it made me really aware of how little we speak about the nature of grief, particularly when you're young and you've lost someone, particularly when you've lost someone who was very young as well. He was 31. You know, finding a group that could speak about that freely was so valuable for me in those first few weeks of having lost him, and just putting the pieces back together again and understanding what that meant.
You also talk frankly about your grief and your bad days on Twitter. Why? Yeah.
I think it's, you know, I come from a very unsentimental family. We don't hug generally. We often forget each other's birthdays. So we're not sentimental, and I find it a little bit too raw to be speaking so candidly about grief and how I'm feeling. But oddly, on a platform like this, in this conversation or on Twitter, it's a way to be frank, to be public, but also have a certain amount of distance between you and the feeling. There is no there's no risk of someone coming over and trying to hug you. So, which is to say, I don't like hugs, but in a particularly raw moment, it's too much for me. So Twitter, or just social media in general, it gives me a way to kind of package the grief, articulate it and process it without pressure of being too close in proximity to someone who is going to give you the wrong kind of sympathy. And I've got a lot of, like, I've got space to sort of say what I need to, because there's no linear way to deal with grief. I mean, I remember reading this other theory. I read a lot about grief, but there was this analogy of what grief was like as being this ball in a box, and in the box is a button, and that's the grief button. And when the ball is big and it's bouncing around the box like a game of Pong, it's easier to hit that button. And when that grief button gets hit, you feel that huge grief. And then over time, that grief ball becomes smaller, and it's still bouncing around in the room, and it'll still hit that button, but it'll do so maybe less often. But when it does, that intensity of grief is just as present. Because that experience is so circular, my reflections chop and change and go from one place to another, and I'm allowed full rein to say what I think, to express something in the hope that it's helpful. It's helpful to me, and maybe in the way that this group was really helpful to me in being able to read other people's experiences, it's something that I can then do as well.
When someone asks you, tell me what I can do, is that helpful?
Not in the moment. The more work you make the person at the centre of that grief do to figure out how you can help them, the less they're going to ask, because they don't have the capacity to figure out what that is.
So what have people done around you without asking, maybe, that has been helpful, helped?
I just have the best support network. You know, the day he died, it was just about it. You know, it's as simple as people filling up your fridge with food. Like, that's a really clear and obvious and practical thing. But, you know, there was a WhatsApp group of like 100 people or so. So I hear, I've still never seen the WhatsApp group, but I just understand that it existed or exists. And people would just mobilize. And there was an Excel spreadsheet and a roster of people who could come and stay with me every night of the week, people who would come over and bring food. I did not have to do anything. Everyone had just kind of made the decision for me, which for me, I really needed because my focus was my kid.
How did a commercial meat slicer come to play a part in your grief story, Q?
I've done some retail therapy, and some of the purchases make no sense, and I've never looked for a commercial meat slicer nor desired one, but one came along in my path and there was a really good deal, and I knew that was if I was ever going to buy a meat slicer, today was going to be the day. And it just felt like something big and audacious and something that Jess would have both simultaneously been horrified and impressed by. And so I just bought it and we had a party in his honour where everyone brought deli meats that we could slice in it and we ate it in his honour and we just knew that it was something that he would have loved and it was worth the $650 I spent on it. It's a weird purchase, but it's part of the grief process and that's, but you know, that speaks to the privilege I have of being able to drop $650 on a ridiculous machine, which is very useful.
How do you see your son making sense of all that's been going on around him in the last few years?
Look, he's doing pretty well and he, you know, it was a really hard thing when Jess died to know that Alfie at two would likely not really remember Jess into adulthood. And I had a friend who is a psychologist who said to me, yes, that's really terrible. Like, it's not great that he won't really remember things about Jess, but what he'll always remember is the sense of being loved by him. So that helped. And in terms of Alfie processing it, you know, he just asks me questions as they come to him. And my approach has been to be age appropriate but factual. So I'm frank about the fact that people get sick and that people can die and that we all are going to die one day, because those are the questions that he asks. Are we going to die? Am I going to die? What is cancer? Will I get cancer? Will you get cancer? And, you know, I tell him that Dad had cancer and it was a serious kind of cancer and we couldn't find the right medicine for him and so he died. And, you know, one of us might get cancer and if that happens, we'll try to find the right medicine. And his grandmother had cancer and she found the right medicine. Death will come to us, but if you're lucky and you're a lucky kid, you'll get to live a fantastic life. And so it's been about being as factual and as frank as possible, because that's the approach we had when he died. Like he was there throughout the whole process and he was there throughout all the funeral planning and we made him part of that deliberately. And I feel like as a result, he's been able to understand what it means in the context of not having a dad anymore. And what's been surprising is that his memory is a lot sharper than I thought it was going to be. And he remembers things.
What sort of things does he remember?
Well, the other day he said, I was dropping him off at daycare and he just said, I like my dad's beard. And I said, oh yeah, Dad had a hairy beard, didn't he? He said, yes, but it was short and soft and I liked the feel of it. And so he sometimes comes up with those gems and I write them all down just to make sure that there's a record of it and that Alfie will have something when he's older so he knows. So there are things he does remember, which I'm grateful for.
What have you created to honour Jesse's professional life?
He was such a present and strategic member of the audio community that a friend, a few friends and his family and myself started up a non-profit fellowship in his name called the Jesse Cox Audio Fellowship. And the idea behind it is to award a $20,000 grant to a fellow in order to help them develop a project, an audio project that they want to do. We're about to announce our fellow, who is fantastic. It's a really exciting time to be in audio, in particular audio storytelling. And it was something that he was so intent on doing, both when he was at the ABC and later on when he moved over to Audible. So it's a way of keeping him present and still contributing to that world in some way. I realize how important something like that is now, because I realize how I'm constantly needing to add something new to his canon, I suppose, because at some point the photos run out and the work runs out. And so it's like I need to keep topping it up with something. So this is a way that we can do it.
Thank you so much for sharing your story on Conversations. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski on ABC Radio.
My guest on Conversations today was Q Min Lu. I'm Sarah Konoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Konoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.